I am Jimbo Paris, and you are listening to the Jimbo Paris Show.
All right. Hello, everyone. I am Jimbo Paris. Welcome again to the Jimbo Paris Show. So today we have Mr. Flynn, CEO, entrepreneur, as well as best-selling author. He's a very successful man. He's a chief analyst, and he's done a lot of things in the business sector. And he could give you a lot of interesting nuggets of advice regarding your own business ventures as well for any new startup people here. So again, I definitely want to see what he has to say about all of this. So, Mr. Flynn, how are you?
Hi, Jimbo. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Excellent. So can you kind of give me a gist of what you specifically do?
Currently, I am considered called a business growth coach or a leadership team coach. So I work with the leader of the company, the head of the company, and his or her leadership team, and help them to fill in a growth framework over a year and a half to 2 years.
Interesting. Okay. For me, as well as some of the people that don't know, what is a growth framework?
It's basically a set of steps that you take to align three areas of your business. One is the people side, the team, really focus on the team, the dynamic, making sure that it's an aligned team and a focused team, a disciplined team. And then it's also connecting strategy and execution together. And then having cash be your primary financial growth metric. So when you're looking to grow your business, you focus on how do you drive cash through the business versus revenue or even profit at times. I run them through a series of meetings and exercises and conversations that help them over time to lay that out and then validate, update it, keep moving it forward.
Okay. What is the difference between cash and revenue?
Well, cash is the only thing on your balance statement or your profit and loss statement that won't lie to you. You can sort of come up with revenue, you can come up with profit, but you can't make up cash. You either have the money or you don't. So revenue is your top line, whatever is coming into the business through whatever means. And that can be, it's different in different kinds of companies, depending on the kind of company that you are. It's just how much money are you getting from your clients to run your business or to fund your business? And then the costs, et cetera, to run your business, et cetera, will then get you to your gross profit, your net profit. But in the end, it's like after all the expenses have been taken care of, you know, payroll and rent and electricity, whatever you have, whatever's left after all those expenses come out, taxes, et cetera, then that's what's left. What's left is cash. So they're really on the opposite sides of the spectrum of the financial viewpoint of the business.
That is really interesting because, I don't know, I initially thought those were the same thing, but now that you explained it, I kind of understand now too. So that's really interesting. So I'm curious about you now. How long have you actually been in this industry?
I've been a coach sort of unofficially for 10 or 11 years, and then I made it my own business in 2015. So at the end of 2015. So that's, you know, 7 or so years ago.
Wow. But you seem like a serious expert in this field. So you understood all of this and figured all this out during those 7 years?
No. And I can't necessarily say I figured everything out either. I'm learning and a student of it just as much as others are. But I did startups for about 25 years. So I helped start 10 companies over that time frame, all in the high tech space. And I was generally, you know, in an operations role, sales, marketing, service, that kind of stuff. And I made a ton of mistakes and bad decisions. And hopefully I've learned from them. I've taken that. And then I've always been a student of business. I've read a lot of books. I've watched a lot of, you know, TED Talks and videos and gone to conferences and just tried to figure out, you know, what, if any, are there commonalities among the companies that do really well over long periods of time. And that's sort of what I put into my book. It's not something I necessarily figured out. It's, you know, I read management thinkers, science, you know, the science of management that's been around for about 100 years. And these are people like Drucker and Deming and Shine and Bennis and McGregor and a whole bunch of other folks. And more recently, really taken it to another level and, or really just often reminded us of the things that were said, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago. So it's been a long journey. I really focused on that in the last 6 or 7 years. And that's, I've found that it's really an interesting situation because most businesses fail. If you look at the data, about half of the businesses that are started end 5 years after they start, and it keeps getting worse. The data that I've seen is up to 25 years, and about 16 or 17% of those businesses are left after 25 years. So you'd think that people would get better and learn and improve and et cetera, but that doesn't seem to be happening. So I really wanted to look at also the ones that are thriving and where there are commonalities in those. And that's what sort of I found. That's what's in my book, focusing on team and strategy execution.
I see now why you call yourself the business growth coach. So this is what drove you to focus in more on growing these businesses, right?
Yeah, it's about scaling them, right? In a healthy way. A lot of businesses grow, but there's a great quote that I often say, which is growth for growth's sake is the ideology of a cancer cell. And cancer cells are not generally kind to their hosts. So you want to grow in a thoughtful way, in a deliberate way. That's what I think most folks don't do. They grow to grow, and then they don't see that, you know, some of the decisions that they're making, they may regret further down the line because they violated who they are or what's important to them or what they're good at or what their core customer really values. And they were just chasing revenue as opposed to really trying to build a healthy business.
That's a really, really interesting thing you said there, because most entrepreneurs would think all growth is good, you know, and that may not be the case. And before I kind of get into this, how did you sort of learn that lesson about good growth and bad growth? You didn't use those words, but that's sort of how I understood it.
You know, it probably didn't really occur to me until I started paying a lot of attention to those management thinkers that I was talking to you about before. And then you start to look at companies that are growing, and, you know, we celebrate the revenue, right? It's fun to say that this company's this big or has grown this much. And it's great to talk about. There's a saying that I have heard and quote often, which is revenue is vanity, profit is sanity, and cash is king. So, you know, if you want to brag to your brother-in-law or you want to get in a newspaper article, then great. It's, you know, talk about the revenue. It's easy. People understand it. But if you're not running a healthy business, then, you know, so let's say you're running a $100 million business and it's cost you $100 million to run the business. Now, you've done a few good things, right? You've employed a bunch of people. You've probably made some great products for people, et cetera. But what you're at risk at is something that happens often and too often. So in this century, we've already had three really big economic crises, right? We've had 9/11, we've had 2008 recession, and then we've had COVID. So if you don't have a lot of cash and you're not generating cash in your business, so it costs you $100 million, and let's say from, you know, 2001 to 2008, that's 7 years, and you grew a business from $50 to $100 million, but you didn't put any money away, and you didn't invest that money back into the business and learning more, then when a recession hit, you may have been in a really difficult situation, right? And we saw that with the airline industries, right? They basically said, I'm out of money, I can't do this, and other industries as well. Yeah. It's something that we don't see because it's sort of behind the scenes of who the healthy companies are. We see the flashy, newsworthy stuff about, you know, growing really big, etc. That's sort of what I've seen.
Wrong, but what do you think are the things entrepreneurs do well, or as you would say, partially well?
Yeah. So the ones that do well, and one is they understand that performance is a team sport, right? Mm. And they understand how to attract, to bring on board and grow a well-rounded team. To have a teamwork, you've got to have people with different types of abilities that are working really well. We don't teach people how to do those things, how to attract and build and grow and develop a great team. But those that do really well understand that. The other things that they do well is they understand that having a really simple and effective strategy is important. And, you know, they have to sort of understand what is strategy first. So really understanding what strategy is, which to me is a really good strategy, is about being different, not about being better than someone else. If you want to be better than someone else as your main motivator, that's super hard to do because you're just always a little bit better and they're going to get better and then you have to get a little bit better, et cetera. But if you can differentiate yourself in such a way that it's hard for them to duplicate what you do, that makes it a lot easier. So, the other things that they do really well is they execute really well, is they understand that discipline and rigor is important, and they understand, have clear, specific objectives that line up over a period of time to grow as we go. And then lastly, I think that other thing is they have enough money in the bank and they're investing their money well. They're highly profitable. So I think those things are what leaders do really well, that have that, you know, sort of enduring quality of a business that works really well over a long period of time.
And I think there was this certain quote that you said, how do entrepreneurs deal with problems that create problems that are in front of them, right? And how is that supposed to work? And what does that have to do with sort of the execution you mentioned towards the end of your last answer? Because I think that would be interesting too.
Yeah, the quote that I use, and I don't know who said it, and I might have made it up, I have no idea, is that really great leaders don't focus on continually solving the problem that's in front of them. Hmm. They focus on solving the problem that creates the problem that's in front of them. So if you keep moving back to the problem that's creating the problem and you figure out why that is, you'll get to a root cause. And when you can modify the root cause, then you've taken that out of the equation, right? And that's the one thing that I do, you know, that if you sort of work from first principles, which is that's sort of an example of it, going back to the root cause, then you'll have a better chance of making it easier to run the company. And I think some of those first principles I've already mentioned, right, around the team that you have, and really creating a great team environment and leading a team really well is a principle that many great leaders leverage, which again, if you do that really well, it makes your life a lot easier because you don't have to then manage them, right? If you lead them and create an environment where they're running the business on the day to day, you don't have to step in very often. At some point, your job is to stop running the day to day of your business, your part of the business. Your job is to start thinking about the future of the business and of your team, right? How can I make my team more efficient, more effective? Do I have the right people in the right seats? Are we doing the right things? Are we contributing to the organization in the way that we should? You keep asking these questions of yourself, and then you'll continually try to improve things and take yourself more and more out of the equation. Because especially the leader, the hardest thing you have to do is predict the future. And predicting the future is really impossible, but you can create your own future. And so you can sort of predict it through its own creation. The best way to predict the future is to create it yourself. And that's really what I try to get my clients to do, is really think about in detail, at least 3 years out, what are the things that we need to do? What are the most important things that allow us to make sure we have a differentiated strategy? What do we have to do more of, less of, better, or start doing that we're not doing? Write down all those things that we need to get done, and then drives our execution and operational side of the business over that time frame. And you just keep moving that 3 years forward. Every year we move to the next 3 years and the next 3 years, you know, by moving 1 year ahead at a time.
But again, you know, and while I do sort of see you as a strategist in a sense, how do you think your clients develop this type of self-awareness? Do you try to teach them that self-awareness, or do you sort of look more into the business and sort of figure out what's going on? Because learning how your leadership is, your executive ability, that takes a lot of very good introspection. So do you sort of help them with that, or do you teach them how to help themselves with that?
I don't know that I specifically teach them. So I'm a bit of a neuroscience geek, so I weave that into it. And, you know, I let them know that at least as much as we know about the brain today, and I'm certainly no expert, but reading about it and studying it for years and maybe even decades. So I let them know that, you know, sort of, this is sort of what's going on, because sometimes we don't even realize that we're creating an issue with someone else, right? We don't realize, but I like to say we put people into threat mode inadvertently more often than we think. So I'll teach them that sort of stuff. So for instance, one of the stories I tell all the time is, so let's say, you know, you and I are in a company together and you're my boss and I'm running a meeting of our team because you asked me to do that. And you sort of were observing, et cetera. And the meeting went pretty good. It wasn't great. It wasn't bad. And very often what has happened, you know, is different now in this whole, you know, remote and hybrid, et cetera. But when people are always in the office, what would happen often, and it's certainly happened to me, is, you know, you might tap me on the shoulder and say, hey, Bill, can you follow me back to my office? I have some feedback I want to give you for this meeting. And then what happens is my brain starts to go into threat mode because I don't really know what you're going to say. There might be people in the room. So now I have this social issue, right? Is, you know, what are people going to think about me? You know, they're going to think I'm in trouble or I did something wrong, you know, so I'm sort of thinking about that from the social aspect. And now my brain is sort of catastrophizing, right? It's like, you know, what did I do wrong and what's going to happen? And this is what the brain does, right? The brain is constantly trying to protect you So it's thinking about all these crazy scenarios on your behalf, so to speak. And this person who, you know, you tapped me on the shoulder and you didn't really realize that by the time I sit down in front of you at, in your office, which is a status symbol, and you sit behind your desk, which is another status symbol, which also protects you, right? You're physically separated from me and I'm in a chair, probably completely exposed, right? So our brain is going crazy at this point. And whatever you say next, I might hear you, I might not hear you, but I probably won't remember much of the conversation because your brain is telling your body, go, run away, right? Save yourself. Because our brain isn't really good at separating what a physical threat is versus a social threat. You know, there have been some studies done when you have a physical threat and a social threat and what parts of the brain light up, and they're generally the same parts. So the brain doesn't really know the difference. And if you think about it, your brain is just sitting in the dark silence, right? It's using information from in your body and outside your body to help it make decisions for you. So that's something that I would teach them, right? Because a lot of people don't really understand that. We, you know, the intentions of you tapping me on the shoulder were probably good.
Yeah.
But my brain doesn't know the difference. So what you could have done, which may have been a better way to do that, or at least more brain friendly, if you will, is you could have waited till everyone left the room, sat down next to me and said, hey, Bill, how do you think that meeting went? And I could say, you know, it was pretty good. You know, there were parts that I thought went well or other parts that didn't go as well. And you could say, no, I think so too. Let's do this. Why don't you put some time on my calendar, a coffee or lunch or whatever, before the next meeting. And then what I'd like you to do is come to that meeting with a few things that you thought went really well and that we should do more of or expand upon. Maybe bring one or two things that you didn't think went very well, maybe with some ideas on how to fix that. I'll do the same thing. And then you and I will meet every week until we agree that this is the best version of this meeting we could possibly have. Mm-hmm. Now, that status thing went away, right? There's a more certainty with me. Now I sort of know I have control. I have autonomy. You know, which you're treating me sort of like a peer. We're doing this together, even though you're sort of my boss. Yeah. You know, and that seems like a fair thing to do, right? So my brain is less likely to go into that threat mode if I handled that situation that way versus the other way.
You know, I really, really like that example because you just sort of broke down empathy in a very unique kind of scientific, well, sort of just your way, you know, and I definitely will be quoting that after this show. But again, that was a really, really cool example you just showed there. Now, I think the next question I have, because again, you have a lot of extensive experience as a startup entrepreneur. How do companies sort of succeed in startups nowadays?
I always give the same advice, which is when you're first starting out, you want to focus on only two things, in my opinion, you know, where you spend most of your time and energy. And that is make sure that you're solving a problem that's worth solving in a way that who you believe are your best customers will pay you enough money to make a real business out of it. The second thing is don't run out of money. Usually the first one takes care of the second one. Sometimes it doesn't. What most founders do is they fall in love with the idea and not with the problem. And I often like to say is that your customers really don't care what you do, but they do care about what you does for them, right? It's a self-interest. So your job is to, again, back to this sort of empathy, compassion thing, right? You should be compassionate. I said, your job is to get them to complain and talk about their problems as much as you can and in much detail as you can, right? It's helping these people really make progress in their lives by solving problems and having them solve a job or provide a job in the highest possible way for them to make progress in their lives, to get over a struggle.
Okay, so from what I can understand, you're saying more so, and I think this goes back to what you said a lot about growth too. You know, what you need to do is you need to sort of scale it in the right direction, which is more along the lines of solving the specific problem that the consumer has.
There's a theory out there called jobs to be done. It's been around for about 30 years. And it incorporates something called the theory of progress. And there are four stages to the theory of progress. And the ones that we're very familiar with are the stages that move us toward something. But there are also two stages that move us away from something, right? Back to this brain that's trying to protect us and likes the status quo a lot. Is that you'll have habit, a factor. You know, we don't do things, new things, because we like the comfort And our brain likes the comfort of the familiar. And then, of course, there's anxiety, right? There's, you know, what if it doesn't work? And what if I don't know how to do it? Or what if I look stupid doing it? Or whatever it might be. And we often solve the problem at the top, really moving people towards progress relatively well. But we rarely look at the habit and anxiety. If we could take that out of the equation, that would be great. When you're thinking about making a successful company, is really thinking about the steps of progress.
Mm-hmm. So what were some of your best collaborative business experiences? And did these collaborative experiences sort of lead to steps that sort of moved your progress forward, or did they inhibit your progress?
So collaborative things often involve some sort of thinking, brainstorming, coming up with new ideas. Mm-hmm. And there are better practices, I think, for doing that. So the best collaborative situations are where that happens. And then as a leader, I think, you know, leaders often try to protect their teams and try to help them a lot. And your job is to get the best ideas out of the team. So instead of coming in and saying, I had this great idea, can say, hey, I had this thought that we're not, you know, we could be doing a better job here in this situation. Talk about that, you know, what do people think, et cetera, and then say, okay, great. Again, let's everybody write down, what are some ideas that you would come up with that could potentially improve that situation? And then one of the ideas might be his or hers, but there might be a whole slew of ideas that either in combination or separately would be the better version, right? Your job is to have the best ideas win, not what the hippo in the room, and the hippo is an acronym for the highest paid person.
Hmm.
And often the highest paid person in the room wins. And that isn't necessarily because they have the best idea. It's just because they have the authority or they've taken over the conversation prematurely. So that's, I think, if you think about those, that's how you, when you have the best collaborative efforts. And that's what I try to do with my clients, is to get them to have good collaborations. So, but the most important thing that we're doing here is getting you guys to talk to each other, to fight in a healthy way, to disagree on stuff, and then come out and commit to something, knowing that it might be right, it might be wrong, it might be partially right, it might be partially wrong, but then say, let's commit to it and give it a chance. And then we can revisit it and say, did it work? Did it not work? Okay, what would we do differently next time? That's when you have the best collaborative effort. That's when the best ideas are birthed. The leader is to sort of set direction and guidelines, if you will, not to give the answer on a regular basis, right? They may have to make the final decision at some point if they can't. The best idea should win. You know, you shouldn't make everybody happy. Sometimes people will be happy in one situation. Sometimes the other people will be happy. But if you can do it on the merit of the idea, then that's a better way to go than trying to water the idea down so much that everybody leaves the room and say they get a little bit.
Because that's another really interesting point, because I think a lot of times entrepreneurs, at least, you know, they have, and even I'm guilty of this, you know, there's two different ideas, and, you know, it's not necessarily about making one group happy or the other group happy. It's more about thinking about the greater good, making the business altogether better. And yeah, you know, that's a really good piece of advice as well. You know?
Yeah. I often have people switch sides, right? Say, great. You know, so you think this is strong. So how would you argue the other side? Right. And that helps to take a little bit of the emotional momentum out of it. Right. Cause we fall in love with our own ideas, whether it's a founder or someone that's not a founder. Right. And then we get emotionally attached to it. And we sometimes irrationally try to support it. And so if you could take them away from that and say, you know, hey, really good stuff. Now argue the other side, just switch seats. And that helps them to get a little more perspective, right? Again, back to that empathy, or maybe just a little more understanding. And that helps you as well with getting better ideas.
Excellent. And concerning all of this, I think we're getting to a really interesting question here that I have for you. Skill set versus mindset. Which do you think is more important?
So it depends on the situation. If you're looking to hire someone, they probably need a minimum skill set, but we often try to maximize the skill set. And then we hire someone who has what we think is they're gonna start with their you gotta hit the ground running, right? Or, you know, they really get up to speed quickly, et cetera. But if nobody likes them or nobody wants to work with them, maybe the first few months will go well because there'll be some speed and velocity to whatever they're doing, but then they'll be cut out of stuff and people won't interact with them, or they'll create a bad dynamic within the group. I think in the long term, you want to hire people who believe what you believe, who generally have the same values that you have and want to help you to achieve your vision. And you can teach them the skills and you can give them the knowledge on the way. But I think we skew too much towards skills and knowledge as a primary way to bring someone on board or do something. I think good in the short term. And, you know, again, we're short-term beings. So it's a weird situation, right? It's like, oh, he really hit the ground running. He's great. But then a year from now, everybody hates this guy. And that's not good, right? And what happens is you end up firing him and then you have to start again. I think it's not one or the other, is sort of the way you said it. I think you have to have a minimum level of skill depending on the job. If you're an entry-level job, you don't have any skill, right? That's fine. But if it's a little more involved, you want to have at least sort of this minimum level of skill and then really focus on, you know, I like to say, do what's called the airplane test, right? Mm. You know, once you got to know them a little bit and talk to them, how would you feel if you got stuck in an airport with this person for 3 or 4 hours? Would you be excited to be able to chat with them and learn about them and et cetera? Or would you be completely in your phone or in your book for 4 hours, right? And if it's the second thing, that's probably an indicator that they might not be a good fit.
That's an interesting perspective, because I would assume most people would say skill set, but you said mindset, because more so in the long term, it's more important that the person has similar values, because you could always get those skills usually.
Yeah. You can train them. You can send them to class. You can do all those things. You can't make someone be honest. You can't make someone be curious. I mean, I shouldn't say that. You can. It's probably a really significant investment, to make someone more creative or more curious. And wouldn't it be a lot easier to find people who already come to the job highly curious, highly creative, highly innovative, highly collaborative, than try to turn them into that? That's just a lot of effort.
Excellent. Okay. So we're going to bring up your website quickly here. Can you kind of tell us about some of the services you offer and your book, Faster and Faster as well, Further and Faster?
Yeah. So what I do as a coach is I do two things at a highest level. One is I'm a leadership team coach. And so that means I work with the CEO or the head of the company and his or her team and help them to grow their business in a healthy and thriving. And that's really what the primary portion of what my website is about. I also do one-on-one coaching to executives, either a head of a company or usually someone that reports to them. I don't do as much of that, but that's sort of my high level. And then I did, I sort of call myself an accidental author, is I wrote a book about 2 years ago. I had never any intention of writing a book. I don't really like to write. You know, there are people that I know that are writers and I'm not a writer. And so I hired a team of people to help me do that. And out came what is, Further Faster, which is basically applying the Pareto principle, or what's more commonly known as the 80-20 rule, to business. And it's not everything that you can do, but it's the things that I think if you did this, you'd give yourself the best chance of moving, again, further, faster, the vital few steps that take the guesswork out of growth. And those words were chosen specifically because the 80-20 rule is known as the law of the vital few. Mm-hmm. It's one of my favorite sayings is few things truly matter, but those that do matter tremendously. And your job as a leader or a friend or a parent or whatever is to really figure out the few things that truly matter in that relationship or that situation, and focus the time and energy on that, because you'll have outsized results if you focus on those few things, as opposed to getting distracted by the shiny object or the tyranny of the moment, the current crisis, whatever it might be.
Okay, well, this has been an excellent interview, Mr. Flynn. It's been a privilege. Are there sort of any final words, any last remarks you'd like to give to the audience before I let you off here?
Sure. Yeah. So I guess sort of a little self-promotion is, love. If you thought this is interesting, you can download my book for free if you want from my website. You can also go to Amazon or Audible and pay something. I get a few dollars every time somebody downloads my book from or orders my book from there. Or if you want to chat further, you can. My information is on there. My contact info. There's a calendar link, etc. Happy to chat with you about either of those situations if you think there's an opportunity for me to help you coach your team, or if you're looking for yourself or someone on your team to have a one-on-one coach and you think that my philosophy and my approach might click with that person, then great, I'd be happy to do that.
Excellent. So again, just for a few shout outs, LifeWork Systems, this is our affiliate and collaborative partner. She is an HR superstar and she's essentially works on helping corporate businesses improve their business infrastructure by helping relationships, teaching things like empathy, like what we talked about here quite a bit, and a lot of other things. So If you're a medium to large size business and you have a little bit of money to spend, please reach out to me and we can give you a quick connection to her. Now, the next thing is our YouTube channel. Subscribe now to that. We're currently going in subscribers. Ring that bell and you can get easy updates on what's going on with this show. Final thing is the Roku channel. Now, the Roku channel is our newest thing out now. This will be on Roku as well. And we're essentially on Roku TV, Roku Box, and anywhere else you want to look there too. Now, the last thing I'd like to shout out here is Jimbo Paris Services. This is our service-based business. And what we do is we offer promotional content. We will essentially make ads for you, make content, and also interview people who are in your business for you and could help market you to that specific audience that you may need. I'm currently working with a few corporate businesses like General Electric, and so far they're fairly happy with the results I've given them. So that's about everything. Thank you, Mr. Flynn. I am Jimbo Paris, and this is the Jimbo Paris Show.
Thank you for listening to the Jimbo Paris Show.